Welcome to Dreaming in Color, a space for social change leaders of color to reflect on how their unique life experiences, personal and professional, have prepared them to lead and drive the impact we all seek. I'm your host, Darren Isom. This season, we're traveling to the continent to highlight African leaders and the continent's role as a key driver of global innovation and leadership. So join us as we travel across the continent, from South Africa to Tunisia, with stops in Kenya, Ethiopia, Nigeria, and Senegal along the way, celebrating the diaspora and all of its complexity and beautiful possibility. This is Dreaming in Color, Africa. Today, I get to chat with Simhara Rea, the CEO and founder of the Diaspora Academy, an innovative institute advancing diaspora leadership, engagement, and impact. A globally recognized thought leader, strategic advisor, and policy expert, Simhara has over 25 years of experience shaping diaspora engagement, African affairs, women's leadership, and global development. Named one of the top 100 most influential people of African descent and honored by President Barack Obama as a White House champion of change, Simhara has received numerous global accolades for her pioneering work. She is also featured in the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture as one of the five individuals in its Next Generation Voices exhibit. Prior to launching the Diaspora Academy, Simhara built and led the Diaspora Public Policy Function at Meta, advising the Africa, Middle East, and Turkey Public Policy Team. She also led UNICEF USA's National Diaspora Partnership Portfolio, working with immigrant-led organizations to expand philanthropic engagement. Her policy expertise is grounded in prior roles with Oxfam International, the U.S. House of Representatives, and the Elders, the international organization founded by Nelson Mandela. A lawyer by training, Simhara began her career supporting the implementation of the 2002 Eritrea-Ethiopia Peace Agreement. Born in New York City to Eritrean parents and based in Washington, D.C., Simhara is a proud daughter of immigrants, a mother, a sister, and a mentor, committed to helping others create the spaces they wish existed.
Hello, hello. Simhara, how are you?
I'm great, Darren. How are you?
You're looking good.
I'm good. I'm feeling good. You're looking good, too.
Thank you. You know, looks have never been my problem. Looks have never been my problem.
You got it.
Well, we're going to go ahead and jump in. Great to have you here. Thanks for making time. And as you know, we kick things off with a bit of an invocation. So how do you want to open up this conversation?
Well, you know what? I love to open up conversations with an homage to our families and our ancestors, and an homage to the people that paved the way for me to get here. And for me, that is the legacy of the Eritrean people that fought for a 30-year war. And that's the legacy of my mother and the life that she gave of service for our independence. So sort of my invocation is honoring the brilliance and strength of my people and all of my people as Africans, as diasporas, as descendants. So I start my morning strong. I start my morning grateful. And I start my morning in peace and ready for anything.
And that is a beautiful way to start the conversation. So let's jump right in. Thank you for that. So you have an incredible story, friend, and an equally impressive background that's taken you across the world, Eritrea, the White House. I'd love to kick us off by taking it back to the very beginning. So I understand you're born in New York City and lived in D.C. as a child before relocating to Minnesota. Mm-hmm. As you know, all very interesting places with significant connections to the diaspora. And so I'd love as an opening question for you to share, how did growing up in these environments shape your early understanding of identity and your relationship to diaspora and your understanding of belonging to that diaspora?
Oh, it's so beautiful. Okay, so I love the way you're threading this question. You know, I do think that being born and raised in New York in my formative years until I was about six really did shape my sense of self as a global citizen, but also as an Eritrean born in New York during the time that I was born. So, you know, I was raised to activist parents that were organizing for our independence, our struggle for independence. And this is the late 1970s. And so we were also a part of many Pan-African and many global movements for the rights of people around the world. So I grew up really keenly aware of the voice that I have and the responsibility I have to advocate. But I also understood that this was a shared experience for people who have all migrated or left their homes or who sit in solidarity, who stand in solidarity with other movements. You know, and I do think that those first years gave me the foundation of who I am so that when I moved to other places as life unfolded and I found myself in environments where there really weren't many of us, right? Mm-hmm. You know, Minnesota is 96% white. I had enough of an exposure to the world and to the beauty of our diversity, and our world being in the United States, but the broad range of Black, Brown, immigrant experiences, and I felt a connection to all of that. And even when I was in spaces that I didn't have a lot of representation, I think I also learned how to look at people from a human place and trust that their spirit would be able to see me. And in some cases, that was not always the case, but yeah.
In many places it was, right?
Yeah.
The spirit would be able to see me. That's beautiful. Mm-hmm. I want to jump in a little bit more and talk about those early experiences and that early grounding, if you will. So you noted that you grew up during the Eritrean War for Independence. Mm-hmm. Both your mother and your father became deeply involved in advocacy while the conflict continued back home. How did witnessing this kind of transnational activism at home shape your perspective on what is possible when it comes to movement building and creating change, even from afar?
Oh my goodness, if this isn't the truth of my whole life, it really not only, like, Dara, I can't tell you how much of an impression those childhood years have left me with, because it is who I am today. And it's because I saw what was possible. You know, everything from demonstrating in the streets to having a community center, going to language school, a lot of self-reliance elements, preservation of our identity, our culture. I remember getting phone calls from different people around the country wanting to speak with my parents, Eritreans and friends of Eritrea. But I also remember how difficult it was to hear from my relatives. And I remember getting letters in the mail. They were these sheets of paper that you would fold, and it'd have an adhesive, and then the outer edge of that paper would be an envelope. So every time a red, white, and blue envelope arrived from a friend, and it wasn't through the mail, it was through people who had traveled and gone through great lengths for us to have the letter. I remember opening these letters and seeing relatives sending messages in Tigrinya to my parents. I still couldn't read Tigrinya at the time, but the beauty of the penmanship. My uncle has the most beautiful penmanship. And I remember that showed me a dignity to who he was and to our people. And we're on the other side carrying that in our messages. So I think it really helped me see what is possible and where you stand relative to everyone else around the world, but also the inherent privilege we have of being in the United States, where, you know, we could really organize and assemble and speak. The last thing I'll say is I think it has shaped me in such a profound way to understand that it is, yes, I have a privilege, but it's also a responsibility I have to use my time, talent, and treasure for good and to take up space, because many of us are denied space in different ecosystems. Even here, we're denied space. And so taking up space was such an intrinsic way of being for us. And I don't want to forget how important that is, that we claim our space, that we take it up.
I really want to come back to that, this importance of taking up space and how we take that for granted, the importance of it all and the role that we play in all of that. But I do want to jump in now and talk a little bit more about something you've spoken on in earlier conversations about how where we choose to live is often deeply intentional. In one of your most recent podcast episodes, and I want you to talk about your podcast as well, you said people express their needs with their voice or their feet. I know you decided to go to undergrad in Minnesota and later law school in Wisconsin to remain close to your family. Mm-hmm. Today, you're based in D.C., where your mother and father served as pillars in the fight for Eritrean independence. Can you share what proximity to community has meant to you throughout your journey?
Yeah, the proximity to community is such a backbone of my life that there was a period of time where I didn't have it. And that period was in college and in law school. And I had my immediate family, but I wasn't immersed in community the way that I grew up. And I think growing up Eritrean pre-independence meant that we were just automatically community by virtue of solidarity in the struggle. And then post-independence, I think we were just getting our sea legs, sort of walking as independent Eritreans, being able to say we're Eritrean. It was just an incredible feeling to be able to see that it's on the map, right? That, you know, it's got its own existence finally, what we've envisioned. And then so part two is how you create community in this post-independence world where some people have been waiting for 40 years, like my family, in the diaspora, and others are new to even being in the diaspora. And so I think that the nexus of and range of community building just suddenly looked so different. It sort of multiplied so quickly. And in those years where I was deeply in the undergrad or grad, really grad experience, it was hard. It was extremely hard. It felt very lonely. And then because I moved after grad school to Eritrea, you know, I had a deep immersion all of a sudden back into my roots. And I think that injected me. I think my time in Eritrea as an adult reminded me of the work I have to do to build a community in this new age, because we no longer have that automatic autopilot community existence pre-independence. And we also have life, you know, adulting. Like, I'm very focused now on the reality of adulting as a diaspora. And I'm very adulting here, but what we're going through in my community is so much about it is the sort of next level of diaspora experiences. We're no longer having to be implicitly defensive about the country and protect its integrity, which we always do. But there's more to it now. We can flourish. We can ideate. We can create. And that is new territory for us. So what does community building look like in that space? That's where my head is now.
And tell me a little bit about your return to the continent and then, you know, your decision to return to DC. And how does being there reflect who you are today and the kind of work you're doing in this chapter of your life? I love this adulting piece. We're all struggling with adulting.
I thought I had it down.
As actual adults, as a country, as communities.
No one knows how to adult because I thought I had it down. It's just incredible the lessons I keep learning about adulting as a diaspora. Can you repeat your question, Darren?
The question of your time back in on the continent, how that shaped you, and then also your decision to come back to DC. Like, you know, what was the intention behind that, and what does that mean for you as you think about the kind of work that you're driving?
Yeah, I mean, let's just frame this for a second. Eritrea became independent when I was a teenager, when I was 14. Eritrea became independent when I was 13, and I made a trip when I was 14 in 92. So walking to Eritrea in those years really was a profound transformative experience as a teenager, because I had just grown up in the U.S. and we all know what it's like here as a Black person with immigrant backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And then to set foot in my homeland that I've just dreamt about for so long and see everyone on the street looking like me, walking like me, no one flinching, no one doing a double take, no one making these microaggressions that we like to call them now. It felt strangely freeing and strangely comfortable. And I remember there's a picture of me walking with my family on Main Street. And let me just date myself. I have a Guess t-shirt on and Jabot jean shorts.
You were rocking the fashions of
I really was. I had Jabots. You see? Ooh,
throwback. Okay.
And yes. Because that was what my world was in the States. And then, you know, I got back to Eritrea and I just said, none of this matters. None of this brand, none of this capitalism, none of this, like, your outfit matters. What matters is your spirit. And I looked at my mom, at my aunt, and I said to her, wow, why do I feel like so happy? And I had tears in my eyes and I just looked over at her and she said, because you're home. And to be born in the States and to navigate what I thought was home and then to feel another stronger pull of home just blew my mind. So that anchoring at 14 gave me a window to what I could experience if I went back. Mm-hmm. And my decision to go to Eritrea professionally really was, again, a community value, because service is a big part of who we are as Eritrean people, of giving back to our country, giving back to our people. National service is something that we've always underscored in our quest for independence, of giving back. And service is more than military service, which people often think of when they hear national service, but it's volunteering. It's what we have here, AmeriCorps. It's your nonprofit work. So I said, how can I use my, again, time, talent, and treasure to give back to Eritrea? And I said, I'd love to volunteer. I'd love to volunteer and go after law school for a summer. And I did. And there was no job for me. There was no opportunity, but you know, you make it happen. You knock on doors and you just wait until they say yes. And you say, you need me. You don't know you need me, but you need me. And that—
Very, very American of you. Yes.
You know what I'm saying? So that's the other thing. So going to Eritrea for a summer, I came back to the States and I was like, that was incredible, but that wasn't enough. I ended up being offered a position to work virtually for the office of the legal advisor to the president of Eritrea as a research attorney in DC. But it wasn't enough for me to do it virtually. And, you know, it's like a sweater when you pull the string. You just get a little bit, then you want more, then you want more, then you want more. And before I knew it, I just said, I'll go for a month, then 3 months, then 6 months. And once you start paying bills in Africa or anywhere in the world, once you start paying bills outside and you take the bus to go to work and you meet people for coffee and then you go make dinner at your house, you live there. And that was really the shift for me, was experiencing Eritrea finally as someone who was living there. And it's not the same because I was a diaspora, you know, I was with a diaspora job, but I had an incredible experience that was rooted in what I went through when I was 14.
Oh, wow. And I'm going to move to broader diaspora in just a second, but I want to also just continue on this topic of space for just a bit. I understand that your parents chose your name, Semhara, with deep meaning behind it. There's a lot of power in a name, as they can both tell our stories of the past and speak to the futures our families imagine for us. Mm-hmm. What is the story behind your name? Can you share that with us?
Oh, what a question, Darren. So taking up space is with, first and foremost, my name. So my name Semhara, when I was born, it was the name of a province in the autonomous region of Eritrea, which was facing a war for independence against Ethiopia, fighting for its independence. And so Semhara, as one of the provinces, is important because it was on the coastal line of Eritrea, which means access to the Red Sea, which is essentially the whole basis of the denial of our rights as Eritreans, was that Ethiopia wanted access to the sea. And they still do. So now, as an Eritrean, to be named Semhara during the war was a direct call out to the province and to Eritrea's right of existence. And so if anybody hears the name,
your name was radical.
Let me tell you. Oh, you don't even know. Listen, this is the thing, is I thought that was radical. And I went through a discovery of my whole name journey not too long ago. So I've been wrestling with this for a while, but Semhara to me was always a statement, and it is very telling. It's very telling of the time that I was born and very telling of what we're claiming is taking up our space, is owning our heritage, our identity. Now, the backstory to this that I don't always share, but I really want you to know, Darren, because I just love the story question.
Of course.
Semhara is the name they gave me on my third day on this earth. And I had another name for 3 days, for the first 3 days of my life. And that name was so beautiful, but also it leads to a lot of questions. I remember around 8 or 9 years old, I was sifting through my mom and dad's things, and I found a paper, and it said, congratulations, it's a girl. And it was a little card, like a business card size. It said, congratulations, it's a girl. Name, you know, date, city, state. And the name was written in Tigrinya. And it said, Warqawit Kohob. And it said my birthday and my birth time, New York, New York. And I said, why does it say Warqawit Kohob? And they said, they gave me the conversation. They said, well, that was a name you had when you were a kid before we changed it to Semhara. So I grew up knowing that for 3 days I had this name, Warqawit Kohob, which translates into golden star. Warqawit Golden Star Kohob. And I thought, why would you name me Golden Star? Like, who's going to walk around saying Warqawit Kohob? And what would happen to me? And, you know, so for years, my entire childhood into adulthood was like, thank God they protected me from being called Warqawit Kohob. And then my relatives swooped in and they said, you can't name her that. Give her something more fluid. Give her something more. Okay, so Semhara is the result of multiple relatives weighing in.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Well, we found out later why they picked Warqawit Kohob. Eritrea's struggle for independence was led by the Eritrean People's Liberation Front, or EPLF. There's another revolutionary group called the Eritrean Liberation Front. So ELF and EPLF, okay? During the struggle, the EPLF flag, which then morphed into the current flag the state has, is red, yellow, green, and blue. And at the center, it has a star. And it has a yellow golden star. Mm. And I realized that they had actually named me after the star in the flag of the movement. And no one verified this for me. I was never able to ask my mom and dad later. But to realize like you're named after this revolutionary movement is even more telling. So between Wadqawit Kohob and Samhar, I take deep honor in my heritage and the pride of my people.
As you should. That's beautiful. So I want to jump. I'm grounded in that. that could have been your invocation. I want to jump to talk a little bit more about borders and the diaspora broadly. And so, as you know, and we've talked about before, the African diaspora is incredibly vast, spanning continents, cultures, languages, and histories. It holds millions of stories, identities, and lived experiences and realities. And yet there's also something shared, some sense of origin, of connection, and of purpose. What does it take to build authentic partnerships across diaspora where histories, politics, and perspectives can vary so widely? And at the same time, how do we honor those differences that define our communities while still celebrating our likeness and what we have in common and showing up for each other and building a collective vision?
Mm-hmm. So when I work on diaspora issues, it's because I understand deeply and I feel connected to the separation and longing to belong and the separation from our homelands. And for many of us, separating from our homelands was a choice. A difficult choice, a choice we had to make because of opportunity, because of love, because of a job. Mm. It was also a choice that we had to make for safety, for fear of persecution, for fleeing from instability, but it was still a choice. And then there's a segment of our diaspora experience where the largest swath of African diasporas were actually uprooted, stolen, and kidnapped, and denied even the opportunity to know where they came from. And so that umbilical, that quest for your umbilical and to connect or reconnect is what I immediately feel aligned with. And the second thing I see is that because everyone wants to belong, everyone wants a feeling of belonging, you know, validating our journeys looks like a few different things. We oftentimes limit our focus to migrants who have left home because of the harrowing circumstances they may have gone through, or we focus on immigrants in their new homeland, which is incredibly important. But that migration story and how it's affected centuries and centuries of people is a shared journey. And what strikes me, Darren, is we have no problem having this conversation around European migration that goes back 200-400 years. People talking about what we did in Europe versus now. When white people talk about their history, it's majestic, it's dignified, it's glorified.
The narrative is beautiful.
The narrative is so heroic.
Yeah.
But Black and Brown people are denied the opportunity to hold their migration journeys with such dignity and such pride. And so especially with African diasporas, I feel extremely strongly that when I see a person of African descent, a Black person, someone who identifies as being of African or Black heritage, there is a recognition that you are strong, you are dignified, you deserve respect, and your journey deserves recognition. And if it's not your journey, your ancestors' journey. And we don't know all of our ancestors' journeys. My deepest question and motivation, you know, when I look at what motivates me around diasporas, I think there is such a fear of Black bodies and Black minds being free, free to move, free to go everywhere. And that fear is even within ourselves. And so at the heart of my diaspora work as an Eritrean, I understand deeply how strongly we needed to fight for our right to exist. Right? And Africans didn't want us to exist. There was Black dissent with Eritrea's independence. And so what is it about Black people choosing their existence and choosing where they want to exist that is so harrowing and frightening for you? And then you extend that and you take that even further into the diaspora journey, and you see that it applies in other parts. It applies to South Asia, East Asia. What is it about the freedom to move and live and be as you want that is so frightening to you? Or what is it that it does to your sense of self and your sense of power? And so I find that ultimately the diaspora journey is very welcoming when it is a diasporic journey in the same sort of homogenous region, Europe to America. we can just read today's news and see what we're hearing about immigration. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to the Global South, and that is the part of the diaspora journey I really pay attention to, is diaspora experiences among the Global South. What is it even about our own people that dissuades them from thinking they can move around the world? And whether it be by foot or by mind, do you know what I mean? Like this freedom, this expansiveness of who we are, it's valid. We deserve it. And I think the innate desire to suppress Black thought and freedom, this is why I love diaspora work, because it showcases, this is what you can do if you free yourself, if you liberate yourself, if your mind, and I'm talking about the mind. Mm-hmm. You can talk about politics and you can talk about culture wars and all this, but I really mean when you realize the magnitude of your power as a Black person, as an African, as a diaspora, it's incredible. And so often that is exactly what people fear the most. I also believe the last thing I'll say about the diaspora journey is that what I've also learned is the diaspora journey is a feminist one. And to be in the diaspora is to be feminist. And you really can't exist in the diaspora and succeed or grow or flourish without accepting feminist theories. And women and girls, their access to opportunity, the power dynamics and the shifts that result in the diaspora require you to adhere to more feminist frameworks. And that is where a lot of tension still rests. So I always like to think of the diaspora journey as being a feminist one and one of liberation. Fathers learn the hard way what it means to raise an overachieving daughter. Mothers learn the hard way what it means to raise enabling and enable their sons. You know, the patriarchy, white supremacy, capitalism, all those things come out in the diaspora journey, and those power dynamics reveal a lot. And I will say, Darren, everything I'm speaking about is our truth as diasporas globally, but it's very pronounced for Black and brown diasporas, because when we go abroad, we experience white supremacy, and we experience racism, we experience institutional bias, and that oftentimes we're not prepared for. When I look at European diasporas, I work a lot with European diasporas as well. So when I look at Irish, Italian, Greeks, Armenians, it's very similar the way we engage as diasporas, but they don't have the barrier of white supremacy, or they have chosen to pass, right? So if you look at Sicilian migration and the Italian-American experience in the US, those were Sicilians who wanted overwhelmingly to integrate and to pass. And we don't have the luxury of passing, you know? So I'm taken by the diaspora journey because of what it's unlocking and what it's requiring us to face, which is our fears, which is our dreams and our longing to belong. And I do think that Black and brown minds, when they unlock, it is not only deeply transformative, but it levels the playing field globally.
And can you, I love this final point, or the one of the last points you were making there around this idea of how other communities, as they think about the diaspora, their diasporas, and there's with it is understood a certain level of assimilation, integration. And I'm reminded of, you know, Kenji Yoshino and the whole covering, right? Like what does it look like to cover and integrate as a way of coming into a country or culture. And with it, I mean, there's a whole level of normalization that comes with assimilation, right? Like you assimilate into a culture and you normalize that culture, you validate that culture. But many of us, we don't have the ability to do that, right? I mean, interest is another conversation, but we don't even have the ability, right, to integrate, assimilate to certain cultural norms or even identities. And what does it mean when you actually have this group that's thriving or living that doesn't in some ways validate the norm and the danger of that for a society? And so, I mean, with that as a question, I would love for you just to talk a little bit more. I mean, we see the upsides, obviously, of the diaspora, but the threat that it poses, or the seeming threat that it poses to standard cultures and how they think about their identities, and how it forces them in some ways to rethink about themselves and reimagine the narratives they told of themselves. Can you talk just a little bit more about that? I think that's a really powerful point.
I do think that we do see diasporas who, while they can't fully assimilate, they aim to sort of align with mainstream. And that tends to be, I keep seeing this trend, it tends to be along capitalism and economic sort of status. And so we see a lot of brown, black, mostly brown communities, mostly South Asian examples of a desire to assimilate into a homeland to succeed economically. And in many ways, that's a desire to be proximate to power. That is about what we used to say, achieving the American dream. But no, it's really getting the bag and securing your life. But when it comes to your people, not everyone can do that, because even in the South Asian culture, as you know, just the levels of internalized racism across by shade, it means that some can't escape that either. Mm-hmm. I find that increasingly diasporas from the global South understand that it's important for them to integrate. They want to integrate, but they can't assimilate. If you're Muslim and you believe in wearing the hijab and you believe in praying five times a day, you're not going to be able to assimilate into this Judeo-Christian white culture. And that's okay. And I think what that does, well, one, it disrupts the supremacist culture. It's a disruption. But it's also challenging. And what is the learning for me over time is, while I'm not here to teach white people, I'm realizing they are observing our diaspora journeys and seeing that it's relatable to them. Mm-hmm. Or at least that's what I'm in the language that I deliver. In Minnesota, for instance, part of the reason I'm so joyful about this work is because I take pride in supporting diaspora communities from all walks of life, especially from the global South. And when European diasporas realize that this applies to them, it disarms them completely. And it forces them to ask themselves, what are the internalized racism that I'm carrying? So when I grew up in Minnesota, I moved there at 9. I went all the way through college. After seeing so much of the United States, I had lived in Louisiana, I'd lived in Seattle, I'd lived in New York, in Boston, in DC. And going to Minnesota and being in a very homogenous place, it didn't bother me. I knew who I was. But when I would visit Minnesota as an adult in my 20s, 30s, later in life, these Minnesotans, well-meaning Minnesotans, would say to me, oh, where are you from? You're Asian. Oh, so when did you get here? You're a refugee? And to be African in Minnesota almost became synonymous with refugee. And it stunned me. And when I would share this diaspora work, and the Norwegian American would realize that I'm doing the same work that they do, or the Swedish American or the German American, it forced them to realize, why did I think she was a refugee? Because I said Eritrea, because I said African. And so I'm not here to try and change their minds, but I think the learning is that our disruption is simply pulling the veil off to what sort of internalized racism we exist in and others live with.
No, that's a solid point, and thank you for sharing that. Yeah, I want to go back to, in many ways, something that was an inspiration for you, but it inspired you in a very interesting and compelling way. And so for many, growing up with the legacy of the Eritrean War of Independence would have deepened a sense of us versus them. Instead, you've chosen to embrace solidarity and champion a sense of shared purpose across the diaspora. What gave you the vision to see beyond these inherited divisions, and how do you nurture that kind of cross-border partnership in your work today? And what do you think is possible for the diaspora when we choose to lead with connection despite our differences?
Yeah, I think it's very easy to get stuck in a defensive position and be so defensive about Eritrea's right to exist, for instance, that you view everything as a potential threat. And I don't do this. There are people who do this, but just even as a Black person, you know, when you are surrounded by so much, as a Black woman, misogyny, racism, it can harden you in a way that you look at everything with distrust. And I think my mother, she passed away when I was 16, but the life that she exposed me to and the mindset that she carried was to lead with love and to lead with humanity. And she was one of the rare ones of the community at the time who was building bridges with non-Eritreans. There was a really strong group of Eritreans at the time in the 70s and 80s. And a core part of that group was building bridges with others. And I remember a handful of Eritreans who did this, who went out of their way to build solidarity against the anti-apartheid movement, Free Tibet, protecting the narratives around the Holocaust, civil rights era. I was one of the few in that space. And I think my mother's insistence that we are all connected, that we are all connected, not just in the struggle, but in the recognition of each other, really framed how I should approach others in this world. And as an Eritrean, I remind myself just how strong we are. Like we're not beholden to other people. Mm. And at the same time, if you know that, then you should be able to lead with love. And you should be able to show people the way and not feel small or threatened or that your existence is threatened by others. Mm. I mean, my mom was very, very intentional. I learned later in life that she became a born-again Christian in towards the later years of her life. But prior to that, she was meditating. She was reading Buddhism. I saw her library with World Religions. And I think I took up the same approach.
Yep. And so shout out to your mom. Mm-hmm. It's when you think back and reflect on how your understanding of people really shaped the world that you live in, it's really powerful to think through and to honor. Just one final question before I move on to a different line of questioning, if you will. But Eritrea's fight for independence shows how powerful borders can be in establishing and protecting both identity and sovereignty. In your worldview, it's a bold question. Feel free to give me what
Bring
you
it.
Like.
Bring it, Darren.
What is the purpose of borders? And how might we reimagine them as points of connection rather than dividers within the diaspora? How do we rethink borders and their role?
I mean, honestly, I understand the argument that borders were defined by the colonial powers and that we should do away with them and that this was dividing our people. And I think to a certain extent, that's very true in many parts of the world. In Eritrea's case, and the reason I am pro-borders for the recognition of our sovereignty, but I also believe that borders should also allow invitations of movement in between. So a border isn't a closed wall. A border is recognition. And for countries and people like mine, you know, we fought really hard to exist. And borders should only present themselves as invitations of how we can engage with each other. I do think often about this border question because I worked on the peace process with Eritrea and Ethiopia and the border demarcation and delineation. Ethiopia never respected it. Like politically, I can say, like factually, we can see it took 20 years for Ethiopia to agree to implement the border. And that's for their own political reasons. But for Eritreans, it meant the world that we had recognition that the border decision was handed down. You know, we fought for our struggle for independence and we had a border decision. And so as Africans and as Black people, it's important to remember that some of these borders are telling a story that we want to hold on to. And then that's our case for Eritrea. At the same time, some of these borders barely exist around, like when I look at conflict and study development on the continent, like if you look at the Horn of Africa, the borders are so porous, like between Ethiopia and Somalia, there's actually an administrative border. It's not a real border. So yeah, borders can be pretty meaningless for many parts of the world. The point is, how are we engaging with each other and offering invitations for exchange, offering invitations for people to move between borders, to do trade between borders? Like the fact that it is so difficult to travel within Africa, obtaining visas, but you know what that is? That is all logistics and the supply chain. That is all about operational. You know what I mean? And it isn't, yes, it is ego. It is maybe people's refusal, government's refusal to implement. But at the end of the day, everything is about just setting up the operational framework.
Yeah.
So I think that we are borderless in the sense of, especially as diasporas, we're borderless in the sense of being able to see each other. Like I should be able to sit with a Haitian. I should be able to sit with a Palestinian. I should be able to sit with a Filipino and feel not only welcome, but seen and understood. But then I also understand that their country has gone through massive struggles to exist. And, you know, it's funny, I just picked Haiti and Philippines as examples of struggle, but their struggle to be recognized and be seen. And that begins with borders. Like as a lawyer, one of the first things we learned in international law studies is that you have four requirements to be recognized as a state. and it's territorial jurisdiction. You know, it's a population. It's the ability to govern. It's that recognition that you are functioning. So I want, especially from a diaspora perspective, to diaspora listeners to recognize our privilege of being able to have this conversation and be able to pontificate and theorize around borders. But what we can do is imagine, and we can dream in color around what it means to live in a borderless world while still in respecting the inherent integrity and rights of people who want to exist in the way that they want to exist.
Wonderful. Let's jump and talk a little bit more about your current work, the Dawn Network. So you founded the Diaspora...
Diaspora Academy.
Yes, Diaspora African Women's Network, and more recently, the Diaspora Academy, with a deep desire to amplify diaspora voices in leadership. Yeah. There was a pivotal personal experience, a pivotal personal experience or turning point that made you realize this was the work you were called to do?
I think when I started Dawn, it was the result of living in Eritrea for almost 3 years, coming back to work on U.S. foreign policy and seeing how many Black women there were behind the scenes in Congress and in U.S. government working on Africa who we didn't even know each other. And I kept meeting the most incredible Black women. I was like, hey, girl, how you doing? Let's meet. Let's do this. Let's talk. And then I realized that many of them identified as being a part of an African diaspora, whether it's first generation, second generation, or multi-gen. I was like, why don't we meet? So a lot of this was really spurred by the disbelief that we were all here behind the scenes and no one knew each other. And also the rage at who is working on Africa and who's being made visible of working on Africa. And so the rage being they're not African and they're not women. And so, but again, because I lead with love and joy, like Dawn was a space for us as women, as powerful, smart, brilliant, African affairs focused professionals to not only connect and convene, but to work together on specific policy outcomes, to diversify the workforce. I didn't know all these things when I started it, but it was really like, how is it that we're all here working for the most powerful spaces and we don't know each other? And you know, community starts with that.
Very much. And I think that there's something powerful, and we've seen it in the work, and I've written quite a bit about it. One, you name a segmentation of folks that are leading the work and think about the work. And then you realize as well that, you know, that group, they bring not only a unique set of experiences, but also approaches to the work and to leadership. I would love for you to just share, like, what are some lessons that the social sector at large can take away from the community of women and their experiences and how they lead in the work? How is it different? How is it better?
Well, you know, it's similar to what we always say about civil society, the need to listen to local civil society around solutions. I find that women in positions of leadership or influence are much more considerate of many different priorities and perspectives. And that same thing we talk about in development of women in the community, if you give them money for a microfinance loan, 99% of it is paid back. It is similar in the decision-making process and in the halls of power that we are able to see the need to draw consensus, but also deliver on what we promised and deliver on what we said, because we understand that millions of people's lives depend on this. I also found that in the Dawn space, and it ran for 10 years, there was such a deep and abiding love and respect for each other as colleagues and as sisters, as Black people. It was a subconscious sort of recognition, because what it did was it nourished us for how depleted you feel in the workplace as a Black African Muslim. In many cases, we also had just the broadest range of diverse members, women. Reconvening was not only good for our soul, it was good for our performance on the job. It was good for shaping outcomes in the workplace. And ultimately, it also led to employers wanting to reach out to Dawn because they saw, how can we usher in this talent into our space? I didn't mean to build like a pipeline, employment pipeline network, but it turned into that. And I think by making ourselves visible for who we are and what we contribute to the professional space, it left such a imprint on particularly the Africa policy world, that I do want it back again. I do want to see another iteration of it. Because once you've been made visible, it's like, how do we continue mm-hmm. the space? And of course, we had the challenges that so many nonprofits, particularly that serve Black and underrepresented communities, face. Is we didn't have any options for funding. At that time, diaspora wasn't even a concept that funding spaces understood. And as a nonprofit founder, because I built Dawn as a nonprofit, I found myself educating the philanthropic space happily, joyfully, but it didn't result in any like significant support from a funding perspective. And I had to make a really tough decision of what the future of Dawn needed to look like. I later realized that, you know, we see organizations like Chief that are now up and running with funding and investment. And that was a business model that I didn't even realize we could have done. You know, so learning about like how we show up in this world as Black and Brown and underrepresented people, and what happens when you're a nonprofit versus a business, versus, you know, these things around operations shouldn't matter as much, but we talk a lot about marketing and branding and how you show yourself to the world, but a lot of it is how you set this up, how you set this up. So I ended up really burning the candle on both ends, and, you know, at the age of 38, feeling really alone, as much as I had space that I had built for so many, you know, thousands of diaspora women, I still found myself living in a very solitary, but at times lonely experience. And that forced me to ask a lot of questions around the power of the network and how we can continue building it. So I had to pivot. I had to pause Dawn, and I have this future vision of what it will be and what I'm waiting to do. Mm-hmm. But the lessons from the first iteration are that we're powerful beyond measure, and we're just waiting to reconnect with each other.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's a perfect pivot from a conversation perspective for us to close out our conversation and looking ahead. And so I'd love to hear about a time when you witnessed the power of diasporic unity. So have you ever had a moment when you looked around and thought, yes, this is what we're capable of when we come together?
Yes. And let me answer your question in two ways, Darren. I do need to recognize that the Diaspora Academy is my job now. So Dawn is the past. So I'm going to try and answer your question with a shout out to TDA. Can you ask me the question again?
Of course. And so I'd love to hear about a time when you witnessed the power of diasporic unity. Have you ever had a moment when you looked around and thought, yes, this is what we're capable of when we come together?
Yeah, I mean, the most exciting part about my life now is because I work with all diasporas, the Diaspora Academy is a space for diasporas to focus on their skills and how they want to leverage their time, talent, and treasure. And I've had these moments where my clients or my registrants for the workshops, literally every country in the world, I have I've had workshops with maybe up to 30 different African, Asian, European, Caribbean, and Latino attendees. So watching a training or a conversation go across cultures, seeing Pedro sit with Marie from Haiti, who's an immigrant, Pedro is a son of immigrants, and then sitting with Berhane, who just came here from Eritrea, all sitting at a table, exchanging notes and trying to share how they could apply themselves to the communities or apply themselves in a leadership way. That's a powerful way. The other powerful way is when I see diasporas latch on to what I've been encouraging to think about, latch on, they come back and they ask for support on ideas that, you know, I remember there was a festival. I had a student named Rami. Rami is a wonderful Jordanian American colleague and friend. He had taken a diaspora leadership training years ago, came back to me and said, we want to host a citywide festival that acknowledges and welcomes diasporas from all walks of life. And the festival, I think, was called the One Journey Festival. And it was just a beautiful evolution of his thinking and of the messaging we have around diasporas. I think that there's a lot of solidarity in the diaspora space when we realize that we all come with the same intentions, that is to live a safe, joyful, prosperous life in community, and that we aspire to be seen and validated and heard. And for diasporas, because there's levels on levels of migration, transformation, and challenges, it can feel really lonely. And so when we can sort of sit up and see each other's shared journeys and shared experiences, it really shows you that this path that's ahead of you is possible. And that's what I like to showcase the most.
The path ahead of us is possible. I mean, I think that's a great way for us to wrap up the conversation with one final question and really thinking about what does it look like for the diaspora to truly thrive? And, you know, as you think about the future of the African diaspora and Africa, the continent itself, would love to get just your thoughts on kind of what are your boldest dreams for the future of the continent, of the diaspora, and what role do you believe diasporic leadership will play in making that a reality?
Yeah, I think my boldest dreams for African diasporas in particular is that we have faced the traumas that we inherited, faced the traumas that we're experiencing, and let go of them so that we can live in joy and love with each other. I think that fear and trauma have really held back a lot of diasporas globally. But for African diasporas, because we've been forced to live with trauma that is so generational, unpacking that is a process. And my hope and dream is that as Africans, we're not afraid of ourselves and we're not afraid of each other's power, and that we don't let the white supremacy space define us. And I know that's a daily existence for us to navigate. But when we see each other, we should immediately know that there's solidarity and that there's respect for each other. And that requires that you trust yourself and that you trust that your brother or sister is coming from a place of love. Yeah.
And so we start with the place of love and we end with the place of love. And it's a wonderful way to end the conversation.
Yes.
Samara, this has been absolutely beautiful.
Thank you
for your time, your thinking, and shout out to all the great work you're doing. Can you tell us a little bit more about your podcast?
Well, listen, my podcast is the most fun place I love to go to. It's called That Second Gen Life with Samhar, and it's really zeroing in on the experience of second generationers, those that are children of immigrants that are in between, that are navigating the middle, and really helping them see that their experience matters as well, so that they can see that how they're the bridge connectors between the immigrants and the multi-generational experiences, and how they have a space in the middle to create, to imagine, to dream bigger than anyone else, because that is the struggle that people went through so that you can do that. So the Second Gen Life, it's wherever you listen to podcasts, and I just love being on there to have conversations with people.
It's absolutely beautiful and it's fun. So thank you so much for that.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for chatting. Look forward to seeing you soon.
Thanks, Darren. Can't wait to see you too. Bye-bye.
This August will mark 31 years since I left New Orleans to head to DC and Howard for college. Only 17 years old, but so fiercely independent, I insisted I did not need a full family escort to campus, just a ride to the airport to make my flight. And as my teary-eyed mother hugged me at the gate, she reminded me, no matter how far you go or how much wrong you do, you're always welcome home. And while New Orleans will always remain home, capital H, since that day I've only returned for visits, some more extended than others, but never to live. DC, Paris, Brussels, New York, I was lucky to have called many places home base before landing in California, my new home, some 18 years ago. Slightly longer than I ever lived in New Orleans. When asked, I shared jokingly that I'm a seventh-generation New Orleans native who expatriated to Northern California. Where you're from was such a straightforward and easily answered question for me, place and lineage being so closely tied. Uptown New Orleans, Carrollton, I'd share confidently. My family had escaped to the then-green university suburb of Carrollton, a full train ride up the river from the more densely populated Treme neighborhood during the height of the yellow fever epidemic of the 1820s. Before Treme, we'd been between the neighborhood of Marigny and the various old river towns, Edgar and Dashery, where we'd arrived as people of color fleeing war-torn Haiti, or Saint-Domingue, as it was called then, when we left its shores in 1791. And before Haiti, well, Africa, obviously. Western Africa for sure, but less sure of the specific country. But the specific country was less important. What it's called now was definitely not what it was called then. And what could be more inaccurate than using 21st century nomenclature to name 17th century ancestry? And so, on my first trip to West Africa back in 2005, being welcomed home by my local host at every stop, Senegal, Ghana, Mali, Cote d'Ivoire, while warm and well-intended, felt insincere to my young years, not ready to truly receive it. Surely my ancestors were from Africa, but home was New Orleans, there in the brightly painted homes of the beautiful black neighborhoods, sandwiched between Audubon Park, Carrollton, and St. Charles Avenues, and the bending Mississippi River. On this trip, as we made our way across the continent, I was greeted once again with a welcome home at every stop, from South Africa to Tunisia. But it felt different, very different. It brought me a sense of comfort and belonging. There's a beautiful N.K. Jemisin quote from her novel, The Fifth Season,
It reads, "Home is what you take with you, not what you leave behind." This time, people's welcome home felt more like they were seeing something of themselves in me. A recognition of a shared past for sure, but more importantly, a recognition of a shared reality, a shared destiny, as members of a beautiful diaspora. And so, as we start our journey through Africa, with a conversation with Simhar in her home in DC, I'm reminded of that golden star that her mother conjured in first naming her. I hope that star guides you through this season's beautiful series of conversations, and that you find in them some sense of home. Once again, we put some music with the magic, collecting the theme songs from our season's guests and collaborators to create a Spotify playlist for our listeners to enjoy. Find it on Spotify under Dreamy in Color, The Continent. Thanks for listening to Dreamy in Color. A special shout out to all the folks who make the magic happen. From Africa Inside Communications, our wonderful producers, Mizute Piri and Tom Kirkwood, production coordinator Gadik Aremba, audio-visual editor Mamamo Giko, graphic designer Ernest Chikuni, and the amazing production crews on the ground in each country. A huge shout out to my Bridgeband production colleagues, Cora Daniels, my ever-brilliant partner in Good Trouble, and Elizabeth Makundi, my Joburg-based season co-host. And of course, our fabulous creative director, Ami Diane. What a squad, y'all. Be sure to rate, subscribe, and review wherever you listen to podcasts. Catch you next time.